The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Just 2 days ago on Easter Sunday, Pope Francis was wishing a happy Easter to those gathered in St. Peter's Square and took a surprise tour in his Pope Mobile in what turns out to be his last public engagement. His death yesterday marked the end of his 12-year papacy and set in train a series of rituals before his funeral and the eventual conclave which will elect his successor. Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Farrell, joins us now to talk about the Pope's legacy and the upcoming conclave to elect his successor. Archbishop, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat, and good morning to your listeners.
Now, the end of Pope Francis was sudden, but it could not have been too unexpected given his illness.
No, it wasn't too unexpected given his illness. And I think anybody who saw him on the TV on late on Sunday evening realised that he was very ill. And as you know, he had been very ill in the weeks before that when he left the Gemelli. So, of course, it did come also quite suddenly in the end with a stroke and a heart attack. I don't think anybody was expecting it on Monday morning, given the fact that he'd been out in the Pope Mobile and toured the square and gave the Orbi et Orbi blessing a few hours earlier. So it was, in some sense, expected, but not at that particular moment. You know, Francis was always a man of surprise.
And in addition to visiting a prison on Holy Thursday, he had also the occasion to greet J.D. Vance on the day or just before he died, which is quite an extraordinary thing.
It was quite extraordinary, yes. And it was looking at that, I noticed how weak he was in terms of even, you know, trying to shake hands. It was a struggle. But as you said, he worked right up to the end. He was in the Regina Caeli prison on Thursday for Holy Thursday, as he'd often done. And he was too weak, actually, to wish to wash the prisoner's feet. But, you know, even in his weakness, profound weakness, he still had the strength to go out to, as he always talked to people at the periphery, the little ones, the people who, we don't set any store by sometimes these people in the world. And Francis was always reaching out to those people, whether it was migrants, refugees, prisoners, etc.
It's funny, when you look at his travels, I mean, he did come to Ireland, obviously, but he also travelled to refugee camps, to, as we mentioned there, on Holy Thursday, prisons, and that's not the first time he did that. He washed the feet of prisoners, if you remember. He visited slums, environmental disaster areas. Yeah. He always worked to the periphery.
Always to the peripheries. Even his very first visit, you know, very often popes went to the, you know, the big places. But where did he go on his first visit? He went down to Lampedusa, a little small island off the south coast of Italy, where many, many migrants and refugees were coming from North Africa, many of them getting drowned in the Mediterranean. And he said himself at that time that he had come there today to pray and to be a sign, as you would always talk about, his closeness. And it was also challenging the conscience of the leaders of the world and the faithful in going to these places. You know, he went to Mongolia, probably one of the only a few thousand Catholics in Mongolia. He went to Iraq. So these places are very much at the peripheries of the church. And you see that even in the cardinals that he selected. He brought these new voices into the College of Cardinals. There were voices from the younger, particularly the smaller churches, and there were certainly voices from the margins. And that was, he was translating, you know, things that he was saying and his hopes. They're not just in word, but you've put them actually into action.
Now, it's probably difficult to live a humble lifestyle when you're the Pope. You're surrounded by the majesty of the Vatican, the wealth of the Vatican. But he managed to do that.
He did, because I think he had that, what I suppose one would describe as a great interior freedom. That he was able to, you know, come into that role in, as the Holy Father, and there was a lot of tradition around him. There was a lot of pomp and ceremony, and he set all of that aside on the very first night of his election. When he stood in the balcony, he wore very simple vestments, just the white soutane. He didn't have any cope or anything else, and you know, his first greeting, you know, "Buonasera," good evening, everybody. That was even so unusual in itself. Then he didn't live in the papal apartments. He went and lived in the Casa Santa Marta, where he got his own meals. He queued up in the queue like everybody else. for his dinner in the evening, and he didn't want people standing in ceremony. I heard somebody saying yesterday, you know, when he came in, the tradition is often when you go into an audience with the Holy Father, everybody stands as a mark of respect. But he made it clear that when he came in for his dinner in the evening, he didn't want people standing. Just carry on with your work and do whatever you're doing. I look after myself.
Now, in the early days of his papacy, there were rumours that he was espied at night walking in his sensible shoes, but not in a white cassock, in something, I mean, you wouldn't be too unusual wearing a cassock around the Vatican anyway. But
no.
He actually enjoyed a nighttime walk. I wonder, was that true?
I don't know. Sometimes these stories were apocryphal, but he certainly would be capable. As you know, he went out and paid his own bill after he was elected Holy Father, which would be extremely unusual, because he stayed over in one of the residences outside the Vatican, and he went across there and paid the bill that he, whatever bill he owed for his stay there during the conclave and during the time of the funeral of Pope John Paul or Pope Benedict. So that was very unusual to do that.
And the extraordinary thing, you can contrast his humility with his radicalism, because he did a lot of radical things within the church. You know, his most famous thing, I suppose, for LGBT people would have been, "Who am I to judge?"
Yeah, who am I? He was asked about particular, who am I to judge a particular individual? He was able to, you know, maintain the teaching of the church, but also had that great ability and freshness to reach out to members of the LGBTQ community and to include them in the life of the church. And yet at the same time, you know, tread that very fine line between maintaining the long-standing teaching of the church. And he had great compassion for people that were, and they, you know, they're part of the people who were marginalized down through the years in the church. And it was, you know, that's part of his reaching out, his compassion, his mercy, his understanding of people who found themselves on the edge of society. And that was a freshness, as I said, that he brought to his role, and very important for the life of the church. You think of even, you know, with the synod and synodality as well, when he went on to, in some sense, plumb the depths of the renewal. A renewal began 60 years ago in the Second Vatican Council. And he brought with him, I suppose, there some of his own shortcomings as well in leadership. When he was back a Jesuit in Argentina, that wasn't an easy time. He would admit himself that he made mistakes, but he learned from those mistakes. So his way of leading then had this great humility, but also that matched by a very deep conviction about spreading discernment and synodality in the governance and life of the church. And he, as you know, he brought women then into leadership roles in the church. He gave them women voting rights the first time ever in the synod process. And he has women now who have executive power within the structures of the Roman Curia. And that's something that he modelled and is asking the rest of the church to model.
Now, the question of the slumbering giant that might be the conservative rump within the Vatican, I won't say the Universal Church, because who knows what way that divides. There are those traditionalists who would love it to go back to that, and there are those who would like the church to be even more radical in terms of women priests or married priests or whatever. But that conservative rump is, although maybe diminished after the appointments of Pope Francis, will still be there and may attempt to seize their opportunity to return to the tradition.
Yeah, well, the Catholic Church is a very broad church, as you know. It encompasses everybody from the most radical people on the left to the most probably radical people on the right. And it has always been able to hold all of those together. And I've no doubt, you know, that when the cardinals get together following his funeral, you know, they will be discerning who is the best man to lead the church. Not who's the perfect man to lead the church, but who do they think is the best person to lead us at this particular time in our history. And that man, whoever the mantle falls on, will have to hold all of these things together. You know, and it's not a question of either conservative or radical left, but any Holy Father has to maintain what is the central teachings of the faith of the Church that have been there since the time of Jesus Christ.
It was,
and yet at the same time, hold out, you know, have that compassion and to preach the gospel, because that's the challenge to all of us, the evangelization mission of the Church, which Pope Francis certainly embodied.
Now, the challenge that faced Pope Francis when he became Pope was certainly the biggest challenge would have been the sexual abuse scandals within the Catholic Church, which it might be argued were not handled as best they might by his predecessor. What would you say is the biggest challenge facing the new Pope, whoever that may be?
I think the biggest challenge facing the Church at the moment is to preach the gospel in an ever-increasing secularizing world. That's the greatest challenge, and that's the primary responsibility of every priest, bishop, and Holy Father. And that's going to be the biggest challenge in the world that we live. You know, I think the greatest growing number of people at the moment, particularly in the Western world, or what we call sometimes the known, people who have dissociated themselves from religion. And the gospel has to be preached into that particular framework or matrix. And that's a huge challenge. And all the other challenges, of course, that are there will remain as well. But I see that as the biggest challenge for the new man, whoever takes up the role.
Do you have any candidates in mind?
I don't, because, you know, I think the process is one of discernment. You know, people often have candidates in mind. They talk about, you know, he who goes in a pope into the conclave comes out a very humble cardinal. And if you think back over the years, you know, some people have gone in. Pope Benedict, I suppose, went in as a favorite. But if you take John Paul, he was a complete surprise when he was elected. Nobody was thinking of him. He was one of the youngest popes ever elected. He was from Eastern Europe. Everybody thought it was going to be an Italian. When Francis was elected, you know, nobody was considering him. He was 76 years of age. And a lot of, I think, even the journalists on the night who had scripts prepared for various people that were considered for papalate didn't have very much text. And they were really struggling for a little while to get their act together, you know, to be able to talk sensibly about the new elected. John the 23rd was certainly another surprise. Yeah. So we should be always prepared for a surprise. The Spirit is working. He's working through the men who gather. And as I said, they're not looking for the perfect man, but they're looking for the best man that they judge out of their conversations and out of the discernment that will lead the Church for the next number of years.
Well, you're probably not a gambling man, but your message to the punters would be, keep your money in your pocket.
Well, I wouldn't mind a nod, but yes, I would be keeping my money in my pocket and, you know,
on this
let the Spirit and pray. You know, it's a process of prayer and discernment and the combination of those things, not just while they go into conclave, but there'll be lots of discussions. You know, the cardinals gather, not just the 120 or so odd cardinals who actually go into the conclave, who are those under 80, but also all of the other cardinals that are living and able will participate in these pre-conclave discussions that will begin in the aftermath of the funeral on Saturday.
Archbishop Dermot Farrell, Archbishop of Dublin, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.